That really is the story of the book of Revelation. That is the story. In fact, we're going to spend the next 8 weeks in the book of Revelation, but she has summed it up. We shall behold it. Now, you need to understand that's not necessarily just a future. We shall behold him. The book of Revelation says, would you like to see him now? And the book of Revelation simply opens up its pages and says, here is Christ, and it gives you who Jesus is in all his glory and wonder. You're going to behold him. The little title of this series that we're using is Living at Peace in a World Falling to Pieces. You can't see this montage, I'm pretty sure, very well, but I would say to you that the pictures up here are pretty much a collage of just the sort of things that remind us how broken this world is. And over the next 8 weeks, what we'll do is simply just take them kind of one at a time and begin to take them off and say, what's behind it? And the artist in the congregation, it's not me, but the artist in the congregation will begin to help you see what the book of Revelation says. This is what's behind the brokenness of this world. Living at peace in a world falling to pieces. Why would I study the book of Revelation if I want to live at more peace? I mean, aren't there people in this room, and you don't have to show your hands necessarily, but aren't there people in this room who said, that book scares me to death? I mean, it's kind of like that strip mine out north of Webb City that people keep drowning in. Why would I want to go swim there? I mean, the book of Revelation is kind of that scary little thing that, wow, I don't want in that deep water. Other people say, I like studying the book of Revelation. Let me tell you what it says. And they're more bizarre than the creatures you find in the book. I mean, there are people that scare you. Give me the dragon. I don't want to deal with you. Have you not watched late night religious guys? There's a reason that airtime is sold cheap. I'm telling you what, there are guys going, did you see Tuesday night's news? Everything it said in Revelation about the scorpion right there in Revelation chapter 2. It's there. It's this, 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 and this. And suddenly you're going, what? I don't understand. What? The idea that this book is a scary book is pretty prevalent. I would say to you that, and other people have said this before me, if this book scares you, you've missed the point. This book is written to people who are already scared. This book was already written to people who are already frightened. This book is written to people whose world is in turmoil, and God, can you give me any peace? And the answer is, yeah. Yeah, I can. Book of Revelation. The church has been born in Acts chapter 2. It's been heady days for the church. At the end of the first day, there's a congregation of 3,000 people. Man, try that one on for organizing. You turn one page and there's 5,000 believers. You turn one page and they can't even number all the believers. By the 8th chapter, some persecution has occurred, but it's still pretty localized, small persecution. I mean, small unless you happen to be Stephen or James. But I mean, there's persecution that occurs. And the church is scattered. When the church is scattered, man, that's like planting it everywhere. And so the next thing you know, the church keeps exploding. By the 19th chapter of the book of Acts, Paul can say the whole world's turned upside down by the good news of Jesus Christ. Heady days for the church. Here's the problem. The world struck back. The world struck back and said, no, we're not letting you do this. And so what you had is guys like Nero. It's a year in the mid-60s. A guy named Nero. You're familiar with Nero. Nero actually started out not too bad of an emperor. But he's the emperor of the most powerful military might on the face of the earth. No one could dream of a nation with more power than Rome. It's the most powerful military. It's the most powerful economic power. It's the most powerful political. I mean, it's a beast. I don't mind telling you, it's a beast. And that Roman world turns and says to the Christians, we're devouring you. Now, Nero, when he does it, Nero is an odd character. Nero is a man who loses all morality. You can't imagine a man with no morality. Nero was. He was also crazier than a loon. I mean, he was nuts. But he turned and began to devour. And so there were believers who were stomped on by elephants. There were believers wrapped up in animal skins and torn apart by dogs. In fact, there would be whole home groups, small churches that he took. And he dipped them in oil and put them on a set of posts in his garden, and he set them on fire, and they were the human torches while he had a garden party for his guests. Nero is crazy and vicious. But it's small, it's light, it's localized in the sense that it's not everywhere. The next century comes. The 70s come. Vespasian is now the emperor. The 80s now come, and Titus is now emperor. And now you're in the mid-90s, and now you have Domitian, who's now the emperor. Domitian, when he is emperor, it all turns vicious and worse. Domitian is every bit as vicious as Nero is. The only trouble is he's not crazy. And the military might turns on the church. Now, what really happened is hard to know. You really can't document corpses very well. How many Christians actually were devoured? How many went into the arenas? How many were torn apart by wild animals? How many killed? We don't know. Some historians say as many as 50,000 by this time had been killed. It's hard to count corpses. And to be honest with you, I kind of doubt that number being quite that high. But how many does it take? Because what they were doing was this. They were killing Christians, and they were taking the daughters and women out of the homes and selling them into brothels. That was happening to Christian women. They were taking the boys and putting them in the bottom of the galley slaves and in the rock quarries. So let's take a church our size. How many here, is it 5 or 10? How many would it take to scare you about your own family? The church is afraid. And you can hear the hobnail sandals of the military marching down, and you don't know whether they're stopping at your door, in your home group, in your church. The church is afraid. Lord, do you know? Lord, do you care? The book of Revelation was written to people with a resounding answer of I know and I care. Revelation chapter 1. Revelation chapter 1. Let's start in with this. By the way, I'm going to be a bit of a frustrated preacher this morning. I'd love to just preach this book, and I will in future weeks. But this morning, I have to do kind of two things, and I'm glad I like doing a little of both, but one's an introduction and one's preaching it. And I wish I didn't have to do the introduction, but I have to. So stick with me a little bit. We'll get into the actual breaking it down as we go further. Here's part of what you need to know, though. Revelation chapter 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ. That'd be a good spot to stop. Let me start with this one. This is what it says it is. The revelation of Jesus Christ. This is not a book about dragons and beasts. This is not a book that's centered on Middle East potentates. This is not about some little boy who's born in some kind of a nomad tent, and he will rise up, and I want to tell you his story, and he will have 666, and he will have microchips that he puts under the skin of your hand, and all those sort of things. Now, it may be about a lot of things that we'll talk about, but this book is about Jesus. Don't forget who the star is. Don't get things mixed up. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And here's what he's going to say about Jesus. All kinds of things. One thing he's going to say is, in all your troubles and tribulation, don't forget he's coming back. And so he will say in chapter 1, he'll say in chapter 6, chapter 11, he'll say in chapter 14, he'll say in chapter 22, Christ is coming back. You will see him. That's a true fact. Your eyes will see the Lord's second coming. Now, whether your eyes see him on this side or the other side, but you yourself will see the second coming of Christ. And he says that. Now, if you knew Christ was coming back, would it change anything how you handle the pressure? Well, sure it would. And so that will be woven through here. But he will also do this. He will describe for you and say, I want you to see Christ as he really is. Most of us do not have a good picture of Jesus. The reason we don't have a good picture of Jesus is because, quite frankly, we saw him, at least through artist renderings, and as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John describe him, we see him through his disguised stage. Philippians chapter 2 says Christ emptied himself of his glory, emptied himself of all kinds of things, and he came in the form of a man. He put on a costume. He came in human flesh. And so when you saw Jesus, you would fall at his feet and say, Lord and Master, because you saw him raise the dead. You saw him speak and things occur. I mean, Christ had tons of power that he did out of that human flesh. But make no mistake about it, you didn't see the real Jesus yet. You saw the Christ who emptied himself. The book of Revelation says, would you like to know what he's really like? And it pulls back the veil, and I see him in his undisguised way. This book of Revelation will give me his glory. That in itself is pretty interesting. What would it matter that I see Christ in his glory? I love a concept that's in Scripture. 2 Corinthians chapter 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 says that the same way that Moses went up on the mountain, and when he went up on the mountain, he looked at God, and just looking at God changed him. And Moses came off the mountain going, I'm a transformed man. His face is transformed just by looking at him. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 says, just looking at Jesus will change you. Just looking at Jesus. Because when you look at Jesus, you'll see the truth. And you will be changed by his glory. And you'll become more glorified just looking at Christ. With that background, look at verse 3. Revelation chapter 1, verse 3. Revelation verse 3 has a wonderful little comment. Blessed are those who just read the book. Yeah, just reading it is a blessing. Now, why is it a blessing just to read it? Because when you look at it, you'll have been on the mountain and you'll have seen God and you'll have seen Christ. You just reading it will cause the truth to begin to change you. You want to be a transformed individual? You read this book. You'll see Christ more clearly. Here's some introduction. The book is written in a style of literature we're not familiar with. I understand it's a genre. Now, the same way, you understand genre. I mean, we have all kinds of music. We have jazz, and we have polka, and you know, and we have rap. I guess that fits in that category. And we have all kinds of genre, okay? Top 40 songs, Beach Boy kinds of things, okay? I mean, we have all kinds of genre of music. And you're pretty familiar that you have to sort through a genre to figure out kind of what its style is. This is a literary style called apocalyptic-type literature. Now, again, you can play with the Greek words, but that is, as you know the phrase, apocalyptic. Apocalyptic literature is written in a style that is visual drama with great big broad strokes. It is a shocking kind of ways. You would never say, the sun just rose. If you wrote an apocalyptic style, you would say, and you would make it huge and big. I graduated from the fine high school, Lamar High School, Lamar, Missouri. And one of the assignments that we had to have to graduate was a bunch of us in a couple of classes, I don't think it was in all drama classes, we had to do a melodrama. We did a melodrama up on the Lamar Square. And let me tell you, nothing says culture quite like Lamar High School students doing melodrama on the Lamar Square. You missed something if you weren't there that day. The only thing I remember about the melodrama in particular is we prepared for it. The director just kept going, no, not big enough. Not big enough. Your actions and movements aren't big enough. Bigger actions, bigger movements. What do you mean bigger? In dying, I've already fell 50 feet across the... I mean, I'm dying. I mean, what do you mean it's not big enough? Bigger, bigger, bigger. But this doesn't feel real. It's not supposed to be real in how your actual movements are. It's about the clash of good and evil. It's about emotions. And when you do the melodrama, you go over the top. This book, and quite frankly, uses a style that's over the top. And yet, don't misunderstand. I didn't say exaggerate. It's the truth that is right on. But the only way you'll begin to grasp it is if I go over the top and how I show it to you. And so the truth, it's written in great, big, broad strokes. Maybe the way you're most familiar with this kind of genre, this kind of literature, is political cartoons. You don't even think twice about them now. You're so comfortable with them, you don't hesitate. I picked up today's newspaper as I came down the driveway. I didn't open it, so I don't know what's in there. But there's a very good chance there's a political cartoon this morning. Now, when you see that political cartoon, here's what you're going to see. You're going to see an eagle strutting down the road, right? Here's this eagle strutting down the road, and he's wearing a top hat. And his top hat has red and blue stripes on it with little stars on the side of his top hat. Now, Your first thought when you look at that eagle in a top hat is go, wow, there's some weird birds on the face of this earth somewhere. I wonder what eagles wear top hats. No, no, of course not. It's not what you think. Who does that symbolize? Who is that eagle? Sure it is. United States or America. You recognize it's got symbols in it. That's what apocalyptic literature does, symbols. If that eagle happens to be strutting down the road and he is meeting a guy who has a turban on, and that turban is a big turban with missiles sticking out of it everywhere on that turban. I mean, there are just missiles everywhere in the middle of that turban, and he's got missiles between his fingers, and he's walking down the road toward the eagle. What do you think what are you seeing? Well, you know it has something to do with Iran and the missile crisis. You don't think, do they really have missiles in their turbans? I mean, you don't think that. Because the symbolism. This book is written that way. Now, I'm going to make a statement that's only partially true. Cut me some slack on this one. In general, this kind of literature is full of details, and in general, the details don't matter. In general, the details don't matter. Have you looked at Impressionist paintings? In general, on Impressionist painting, the details don't matter. Here's where I'm not telling the truth. This book is so cleverly written and is so woven together and is so wonderful in what God does. He weaves together some wonderful things that are hidden in the details that you really go, wow. Wow. Let me use a quick illustration. Chapter 1, verse 6. You're going to be a kingdom of priests. You're going to be a kingdom and priest. I wonder where that ever showed up before. Never thought about it. I mean, that's what he says. Well, do you know when God calls the nation of Israel out of Egypt and says, don't be like the Egyptians, stop being there, become my people, a kingdom of priests. He uses the exact same words. And so when God says to the nation of Israel, stop being slaves and start being my people, that's the exact word he uses over here. Only this time it's stop being slaves to the Romans and stop living among the Romans and stop compromising among the Romans. And he uses a detail that pulls back in Exodus 19. There are 500 references from the Old Testament that are woven seamlessly into this book. 500 references from the Old Testament that are just woven in some of the details. Let me give you another quick one. In Revelation chapter 2, verse 10. In Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, he's speaking to the church at Smyrna. Here's what he says to the church at Smyrna. Do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you'll suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful at the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life. You're going to be tested for 10 days. Tested for 10 days. Now, in general, I've told you the details don't matter. It's the broad paint strokes that matter. But on the other hand, 10 days. That's kind of a funny little line. Why does he say 10 days? Where do I know the phrase 10 days from? Now remember, I got to think about people who are sorting through their knowledge of the Old Testament. Daniel. Remember Daniel's carried off in captivity? And he's in a nation that holds him captive. And he is in the middle of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth at that time. And they say to him, eat the things on the king's table. You be like us. You talk like us. You walk like us. You spit like us. You be like us. And Daniel said, no, I won't be like you. And I won't even eat the things off the king's table. And they said, you have to. And Daniel said, you try me for 10 days. You test me for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, Daniel doesn't look like them. And he stands and you have this 10-day period. Lo and behold, he weaves in. Guess what, gang? You're standing in front of the world saying, test me for 10 days. And see, I will not become like you. He weaves in little details that are sweet little accent marks. Why would he use this style of writing? The answer is the church could pass this style of writing around. And it's sedacious material. I mean, this is sedacious material. This stuff says, by the way, the Roman army doesn't win. This means the beast and the harlot doesn't win. I'm telling you, the government's oppressing you. They don't win. It is a powerful deal. And they can pass it right under the Roman noses, and nobody even really knows it. And as Dean Jones says in one of his pieces, when you pass something under a Roman nose, you've passed it quite a ways. You can take this and pass it around to the churches, and it's, there it is. It's apocalyptic literature. It's also this. It's also a letter to actual churches. Now stay with me. I know I'd love to get into preaching it stronger, but stay with me. You just have to have some background. It's actually written to seven churches. I don't want to break you guys' neck as I walk back here, but some of them really need it. Seven churches. Those seven churches are actually seven churches that are, well, John is on the island of Patmos. It's a penal colony. It's about 8 miles long, 4 or 5 miles wide. It's just a rock where you get sent to for penalty. Most people were working in the rock quarries. He's just too old and they won't put anything. So he's just there. But it's sent to seven churches that are about 50 miles away over in Ephesus. Now I'm going to use my watch as an illustration only. I never really pay any attention to it, but as an illustration, I'll use it. If you were to take your watch, what he writes to is he writes to seven churches that are a postal route that takes 250 miles to go clockwise around. On your watch, if you use the number seven, that's where Ephesus is. And if you would go north, you'll go from Ephesus to Smyrna to Pergamum. That's taking you up 8, 9, 10, 11. It moves over to about number 1 on your watch, where Thyatira is, and then it comes down to Sardis, and then it comes on down to Philadelphia, and then from Philadelphia, it ends up at Laodicea about 5 o'clock. So from 7 to 5 on your watch hand, you can see those seven churches. They're the real-life places. Why does he do that? If I were to preach the perfect sermon for this crowd, the perfect sermon, that's what we daydream about. It hadn't happened yet, but if it ever happened, I'm telling you, that's my daydream. If I were to preach the perfect sermon to this congregation, and I started it off with this way, Chip Watson, stand up. And I would have Chip Watson stand up, and I would say, Chip, I know you. Now again, I got the perfect sermon, and I say to you, this is what God says to you, Chip. And I nailed exactly details in your life and things about you, and I spoke to you. I'm guarantee you could hear a pin drop in this room when I speak to Chip. When I move back up there and I say, Dan Peitsch, stand up, and I have Dan Peitsch stand up, and Dan stands there and I say the exact thing that'll be said to him. Jamie Green, I want you to stand up. And if I went around to seven people in this room and told precisely things that are true in your life, this room would get very, very quiet. But you would very quickly realize, I'm also holding up a mirror, for they are also you. And you would begin to realize that the seven just represent what all the rest of us struggle with. And he writes to those seven churches, and then he says, you all pay attention to what the Spirit has to say to the churches. You pay attention to what the Spirit has to say to the churches. Oh, that's enough introduction. Let me take my last 5 or 6 or 7 or 20 minutes and let me say what I want to say. We got to get into the text. This is the part that actually, this is the fun part. So what's God have to say? Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. I, John, your brother and companion in the tribulation. That word suffering in your international version is the word tribulation. It's the same word Jesus said that in this world you will have tribulation. Be of good cheer, have overcome the world. This is the word. John writes to the churches and says, I, your fellow brother in the tribulation. You know, one of the great questions people always want to know is when's the tribulation start? The answer is, it started. You're living in the tribulation. Now, we'll talk more about it as we get into the book, but you're living in the tribulation. That single mama trying to hold together two jobs and take care of these kids because somebody in a broken world walks out and abandoned their responsibility. That mama who's exhausted at 2 a.m. trying to finish up some laundry so she can get to work by 6:30 a.m. on a set of tires where one of them's flat half the time. You ask that woman, are you living in the tribulation? And her answer needs to be, yes, this is hard. This is really hard. You ask the Christians in China or Sudan. You ask the man who's laboring at a place where godliness is the mocking point in a factory, and that man lives with purity. And what he hangs in his locker is pure compared to all the other lockers around him. And that man lives with mockery and laughter. That man lives in the tribulation. And so to the church, the first thing John says is, gang, I know where we are, and I know what we're enduring. Is there anything the Lord has to say to people in tribulation? Here it is, verse 10. And on the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet, which said, write on a scroll what you've seen and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus and Smyrna and so forth. Verse 12, I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands was someone like a son of man. That's Jesus' favorite title for himself, by the way. Dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. That, by the way, comes out of Daniel when the Ancient of Days, God himself, reveals himself on the throne. Verse 15, his feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice like the sound of rushing waters. His voice thundered like a waterfall. And in his right hand he held seven stars, and of his mouth came a sharp double-edged sword. I don't want to distract you with this illustration. No, this is true. John fell in love with Jesus and called him Master and Lord. Just on the basis of the physical Jesus he had seen before. And the physical Jesus he'd seen before was worth worshiping. But the Jesus he'd seen before wasn't in all his glory. You know what the average male, the average Jewish male in the time of Jesus, in the first century, the average Jewish male was between 5 foot and 5 foot two in height. There's a good chance Jesus was 5'1". You thought Zacchaeus was short. The average male weighed 110 pounds. We're porkers compared to them. They would look at me and say, both of you get out of that suit, you know, one of you, you know. John knew he was Lord and God when he saw Jesus at 5'1", 112 pounds. But this time when I turned around and saw Jesus, it was no pale Galilean. When I turned around, it was no flannel-graph Jesus. When I turned around, it wasn't the Jesus who had worn the robes of a frail guy. When I turned around, I saw Jesus. And his description explodes with this: do you think this is a Jesus sufficient enough to take care of you? Do you think this is a Jesus strong enough to stand beside you? Do you think this is a Jesus who you could trust with your life? Do you think this is a Jesus that would cause you to be less afraid of the beast and the dragon and the prostitute and so forth? This is the Christ who stands beside you. We'll talk about that. Well, where are you, Jesus? Where are you? Are you off checking out the Milky Way? Maybe you're over checking on Pluto to see if it really is a planet or an ice ball. I mean, where have you been, Jesus? And the answer is, I am right in the middle of my churches. I haven't gone anywhere. I am right here. I haven't moved an ounce. I'm in the middle of my churches. And he has this profound, wonderful sense of nothing you're going through are you going through alone. A couple of things that I would just comment real briefly. If you could see from an eternal perspective your hard situation right now, would it change anything? Would it change anything? I mean, it's really difficult right now, but if you could see it from an eternal perspective, if you could see it standing beside Christ, could you handle that hard situation any differently? The answer is, of course. Of course. And he begins to talk to the churches about an eternal perspective. But here's what I really want to mention. I went to Wyndham Country School from first through fourth grade and had a wonderful experience. I really did. But my third grade year was horrible. My third grade year was a tragedy. My third grade year, we had a teacher, and I wouldn't use his name because there's probably still some family around somewhere, but third grade teacher was lazy, the one I had in that year. He was lazy. He was a bully. He was an insecure, poor teacher. Now, in Wyndham Country School, you had first through eighth graders. He was afraid of some of the seventh and eighth grade boys. I mean, he honestly was. And because they embarrassed him regularly and he didn't know what to do with them, he took out his insecurity, his bullying, and he took it out on second and third grade little boys. There weren't any first grade boys. And so we second and third grade boys, we took his wrath. My sister, Gwen, who was in first grade at the time, would come home and she would cry to my parents and she would say, those little boys didn't do anything to deserve some of that. And those little boys, and my sister would explain what had happened. On the one hand, to use what I said a minute ago, as hard as third grade was, looking back at it as a 52, 53-year-old man, I have to confess, a longer perspective lets you handle hard things differently. But here's the part I want you to hear. My dad must have heard my sister crying out clear enough. But one morning when my sister and I cut across and we walked through the country to get to the country school, it was 17 miles, it was snow, it was uphill, it was really bad. We didn't have any shoes, but we were glad to do it. I'm just telling you that right now. We had the hope of shoes someday. As we walked that mile and a half or whatever it was to the school, my dad had left earlier and had gone around the road and we didn't know it. My dad went and met that teacher. My dad went into an empty classroom with the teacher, and while that man could bully second and third grade boys, here's what my father said. My father, who always defended teachers, said to this man, whatever my son or these other little boys deserve, you give it to them. But my father drew a line, and my father said, this far and no farther. You're not dealing with second and third grade boys, you're dealing with me. This far and no further. This is your line. You can't cross it. And that man, I didn't know the whole story. My world changed that day. The day my father drew a line and said, this far and no further. Lo and behold, I'm dealing with a world that's very, very hard. And the Lord says, I want you to know, I know about the beast, I know about the dragon, I know about the prostitute, I know about all this. And I want you to know, this far and no further. You live in the tribulation, but you're not at their mercy, I promise you. This far and no further. The fact that the Lord's with His churches is good news. The fact He's in the middle of His churches also is bad news. You see, this book is not only about God comforting His saints. This book is also about one other thing. Do you know what He actually has to say when He begins to open His mouth? He doesn't speak to the dragon. He doesn't speak to the beast. He doesn't speak to the prostitute. You know what Jesus actually says? It says this, I've been in the middle of my churches and I'm sick and tired of you selling out. You're compromising. And you're compromising to the prostitute. I have this against you. I've seen what you're doing. Stop compromising. God's first word today isn't to the White House or to Red Square or Tiananmen Square. God's first word is to the church. Stop compromising. If you're going to be my disciples, live like sold out, completely mine disciples. Don't compromise. And the book will begin with God's judgment falling. But it's not on the world, it's on the church. Woven through this book are two things. Those of you that are hanging on faithful, hang on, I'll take care of you. This far and no further can they go. And those of you that are compromising, I know who you are. This morning, He's still here. And if you came in this room with an immoral lifestyle but still calling the name of Christ, if you've sold out to our economy, you've sold out to our world of sex, you've sold out to anything else, I promise you, your biggest problem isn't the dragon or the beast. Your biggest problem is you have a living Savior who in all His glory said, I won't take compromised believers. This morning, we start the study of the book of Revelation, and God has a word to the churches.